When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Everybody, welcome back to the Fenway Rundown. This is Mass Live's Red Sox podcast, and I'm your host, Chris Cotillo. Today, we actually have a Mass Live alum, somebody who is very familiar to Red Sox fans for his long stint covering the team in a very mediocre fashion. We have Evan Drellick from The Athletic. What's your official title now? Are you business of baseball writer? What do they pay you for over there at this point?
Senior writer, national writer, business of baseball writer.
Wow.
Not Chris Cotillo, you know, any of those work.
It's a lot of fancy terms. Yeah. Well, you are shockingly useful for once in the middle of this labor dispute, because you do have your proverbial finger on the pulse of what is going on with a lot of coverage at The Athletic and on Twitter about the lack of progress that has taken place between Major League Baseball and the Players Association over the last 2+ months. Everybody knows baseball is locked out. There is no end in sight. Looks like spring training is going to be delayed. So I thought we'd bring you on and do kind of a lockout 101 for the people out there that don't really know exactly why this is happening or when it's going to end. So, I'll just open it up to you now. There's a meeting yesterday. Sides got together for about 90 minutes on core economics. Sounds like there's another meeting today, Wednesday, as we record, on non-core economics, which you can explain the differences there. But after yesterday's meeting, not a lot of progress. Where do things stand at this point, Evan Drellick?
Spring training is likely to be delayed, and they are very far apart. You know, the difference between yesterday, Tuesday's meeting, and Wednesday's meeting, today's meeting, I don't know when you're publishing this, so sorry if I'm screwing you up, is, like you said, core economics versus non-core. So, you know, there's the meat and potatoes stuff is how many years does it take a guy to get to arbitration and the minimum salary, like all the stuff that really moves the money is the most contentious stuff. But in a collective bargaining agreement, there's a lot of other subjects they've got to work out. You know, for example, the joint drug agreement or the domestic violence policy, you know, and there are plenty of other areas. So today's meeting, the non-core meeting, is it's not talking the real money issues. It's talking the other issues that they got to sort out and have ready to go at the point that they do get the money issues sorted out. But, you know, if you go down the list of topics, even just inside the money,
we can,
you know, they're very far apart on basically all of them.
And so, you know, I know that you're probably asked this, you know, privately and publicly all the time of handicap for us, you know, your percentages of what are the odds that spring training starts on time? We're at zero for that one now.
Virtually. Yeah. We're just too close. You know, if you mean spring training starting on time being pitchers and catchers report February 15th or so, or 14th or 16th, depending on whatever your team says, you know, in the sense that, like, you're taught as a reporter, you don't totally rule something out that's like physically possible. So yeah, is it physically possible they could do something? Yeah. Are they gonna? No, they're very far apart. And while we may believe in miracles in other respects of life, I don't see one that will get a deal done for guys to report to pitchers and catchers, you know, the pre-planned date of mid-February.
In 2 weeks. And then opening day, where would you handicap that right now?
It's, you know, the closer we get to it and the less progress there is, it's just steadily declines.
Of course.
Yeah. And I wrote a column a couple of weeks ago. You should go read it, theathletic.com. That's, I think going to be relevant for a while. Like, I think after a lot of these meetings, I could basically say the same thing again and again. The question, we know the players want to change, right? They're the ones who want, they're driving the push for making change. The owners are basically okay with the status quo. It seems pretty clear to me that the owners are not going to just hand over what the players want. And you can sit there and go, well, why would they? Totally fair question. Mm-hmm. But so if you know that and you go like, well, why would anybody just hand something over unless you have to? so then it comes down to a question of, well, how much do players want the change and how much are they willing to fight for? Because it's very clear that the owners are going to make them fight. So if indeed the players sit there and go, no, we really need to have more changes than they're giving, then I think the regular season is absolutely going to be impacted, because unless, you know, there's some massive change of heart, and there could be, but you know, the owners aren't giving what the players want. So the only recourse you have then is to not play.
And what do you think the shortest spring training they can feasibly pull off is? 3 weeks, 3.5 weeks? I know they did it a couple of years ago, but this is different because they didn't have, you know, spring training before spring training 2.0 this time around, if it does get shortened.
Yeah, I don't know. How much did in 2020 when they did the summer camp, when they restarted it, how much did the fact that they had had spring training in March matter, right? Because it was already, it was June at that point.
July.
Yeah.
There's still something.
I mean, if you throw a baseball 3 months ago, I think they're self-contained at that point. So no, you're not going to see something shorter than 3 weeks like you did. I think it was like 22 days in 2020. You're not going to see anything shorter than that. But, you know, you get different opinions. Some people might think that really you shouldn't do 3 weeks. You should do 4 weeks. So we don't know exactly what the union and the players feel about it. I do know there's some pitchers out there who think it should be 4 weeks. Yeah. So assume
pitchers are going to want longer than position players, as always.
Yeah. So, all right. So assume that 4 weeks is the, you know, be conservative. You know, if it's going to take 4 weeks, then if you want to start the season on time, you've got to get guys down to spring training, you know, basically in that first week of March.
I know that, you know, in terms of big picture, there are things that the players want to fight for that are going to advance the game moving forward and set up future players. And the things that have come out of the CBA are going to be, you know, very impactful for a long time, but just in the short term after. And obviously the shortened season 2 years ago was nobody's fault, you know, baseball and nobody in the world had control over that. But how damaging is it short-term product-wise, attention-wise, relevancy-wise, to have potentially your second shortened season in 3 years, and what that does kind of to the product just in 2022? And the other question there is, does baseball care?
It's not that either side doesn't care. It's that they care more about their bottom lines.
Yeah.
And you know, you can rightly start to question, well, where do those intersect? Where and that's really the whole game, right? Is how many games do you miss before it doesn't make sense to miss games anymore? You know, I did a story in 19 on trying to understand these bigger picture questions about the health of the game. And I sat down with Manfred briefly, 10 minutes or something, 15 minutes. But at the start of the conversation, he held up his cell phone. I told this in a couple other places, but I like this anecdote. He holds up the cell phone and says, this is a problem. Like he's showing me the phone. This is a problem.
Yeah.
Meaning that young people, old people, anybody, and young people are a special group, but everybody has entertainment options in their pocket now, right? So baseball is competing with Netflix, not just basketball, not just football and hockey, and go down the list. So it is a very different and rapidly changing entertainment landscape in 2022. That was the case in 2020, but it's not, you know, in recent times, certainly different than it was in 1994, 95, when you had the last work stoppage in baseball, right? So it's already kind of perilous where you've really got to do a lot and make changes and adapt to keep your fan base's attention. So in that context, it's not a great thing to give people, make it easier for them to just pick up their phone and go, oh screw it, I'll just, you know, go watch Hulu or whatever it is. It's just so easy to turn away. History shows that people do come back to baseball. You know, you can argue it took a steroids infused scandal to do it. You know, I don't think it's put it this way. I'm not ready to sit there and go, baseball will be dead if they miss X games. I don't think missing a regular season in its entirety would be good. I also don't think that's going to happen. I don't think there's any way they miss an entire regular season, because there's just way too much money on the line relative, like even adjusted for inflation, the sport makes so much more money than it used to. What was the other part of that?
Well, we'll just do they care. And you said that they, you know, the intersection of what they care about versus the short-term loss. which I think answer both parts.
Yeah, I they care about their bottom lines, right? You know, it is true. You know, fans don't have a seat at this table directly. They indirectly do with, like, you know, you vote with your wallet, but they care about, they are self-interested parties. Make no mistake about that.
And what about the theory that they think that they can just roll the balls out, start whenever, and people are just going to flock? And they think that, you know, they're the game, whether that is the owners, the players, or both, think that they're, you know, above the idea of losing fans who will not come back.
There probably is a general confidence that the sport's not going to disappear because of some missed games. I assume that there's an understanding as well that there could be certainly short-term impact where people would turn away. You know, I mean, the sport does have, I think they call it the national pastime, right? Like, you know, they can rest on their laurels a little bit that people do love baseball and have always loved baseball and will always be there. But it's essentially trying to predict the future. Like, could this time be different? Could, because there's so many other entertainment options, it be different? I don't know. I think I'm a relatively smart guy, but they haven't taught me how to see the future just yet. I think it's, you know, it's kind of the same answer as the previous one. They have enough confidence in their position in this country that, I mean, we'll see, right? Maybe they'll get a deal before opening day. But I right now, I don't think either side is opposed to the idea of missing games simply on the basis of the sport will die if we miss games. It would depend on how many games you miss.
So take us, you know, and I know you're not necessarily in the room, but if a better knowledge of what the room is like, then I would say most people, or 99.9% of people. So is it really, you know, like the suits come in from either side and they throw a proposal across the table and then they look at it and scoff and scream at each other, or what are those meetings actually like?
Yeah, it's basically right. Most of these meetings are one side presenting something to the other, and then there's some discussion, and occasionally, as there was Tuesday and as there was last week on Monday of the prior week, sometimes it gets very heated. You know, it's kind of an airing of the grievances and a venting. But, you know, basically the union or the league will call the other up and say, look, we're going to make a proposal on X, Y, and Z. Sometimes it's a broad, you know, sometimes it's like three different areas. Sometimes it might be one area. Sometimes it's the whole kit and caboodle, you know, so
it's the first kit and caboodle in Fenway rundown history, I'm pretty sure.
I'm an old soul, my friend. Yeah. And so, you know, then they'll get together, and it kind of depends on the setting of how many people go. So, you know, right before the lockout started, both sides were in Dallas, and you had the players had their board meeting. So that you had a lot of players there in person. You also had the entirety of MLB's labor policy committee, which is seven owners. Right. So they were all in a room at points, not at all points though in Dallas, but, you know, they were all in the room. Mm-hmm. What's been happening in New York now this month, well, I guess last month, just became February, but in the last couple of weeks, is you have the smaller contingents will come in person. So it's been basically 40 aside. Dan Halem, lead negotiator for MLB, Morgan Sword, who's, I think he's either an EVP or SVP. He's a top economist, baseball ops. He's a very central figure with them. Another lawyer, mm-hmm. Patrick Houlihan. Yeah, three or four guys walk on. And Dick Monfort, who's a chair of MLB's labor policy committee, he'll be there. And then you have other people on video. So on Tuesday of this week, there was only four people from the union who walked over to MLB's offices, but you had another 20 to 30 players by video, and you also had owners that way. So, and then, you know, they yell at each other for a bit, and one side makes a proposal, and then they say, okay, we'll think about it, we'll get back to you. And then they schedule another meeting, and round and round we go.
And then Jeff Passan tweets out that a deal was not reached. A deal was never going to be reached, right?
You know, it's a smart shtick right there. Because that is really the thing people care about, is simply, is there going to be a deal today? Like, yeah, you could tweet every day. You know, it's going to be a while before we get to a point where anybody could tweet, well, there could be a deal today.
Well, I mean, you'd never lower yourself to like a daily shtick on Twitter, like, you know, lineups out, or
correct.
They don't really lose much, do they? Which
Yeah, that was that's the deep cut right there. They don't really lose much, do they?
It's
a deep cut.
And then I like to take credit for your lead when they won the World Series, because I told you you should use that as your lead. And there it went on NBCSportsBoston.com.
Yeah, I don't know if that's a good thing or a bad thing, that my creativity at that point was reduced to something I had tweeted, you know, however many times. Yeah. But thanks, Chris. Yeah.
Anytime. Yeah. You can pay me back by, you know.
No, they fired me about 5 months later, so it's probably your fault.
Yeah. Well, in that case, I had nothing to do with it. We're going to go rapid fire kind of on the issues in a second, which I know is can make some eyes glaze over. But in your mind, where is the needle going to be moved? Like, what are the pieces of this puzzle where you think there's actually a chance at the tangible progress, I guess, relatively soon? And, you know, where can common ground be found here?
So the union's approach, the players' approach, has been to say, we want to make overall gains, right? That's the kind of the top line thing. But they haven't stood there and said, we have to have X, we have to have this in this one area, right? They've positioned themselves to have kind of an open mindedness. Well, if we get, let's say we get, you know, an extra $200,000, I'm making numbers up, right? But an extra $200,000 on the league minimum, the minimum salary. Well, then maybe you don't need quite as much money coming to you in another area, right? That you know, it's the totality of the things that the union is pushing for. There is a leverage strategy with that, right? If they stood there and said, you know, 6-8 months ago, this is our bottom line, this is what we need, or we will not play, then that's all, you're never getting more than that bottom line, right? There's all sorts of strategy involved here, right? And it's not always easy to parse, but that's what's at play. Neither side wants to give away their leverage. The most interesting part is probably getting young players paid more money, because both sides have a conceptual agreement on a bonus pool for guys who haven't reached arbitration. Right? The league wants to pay those guys, they want to allot $10 million. The union's saying, no, $100 million. That was the latest proposal. So there's a huge gap there. All right. But you have at least a conceptual common ground. And so if that conceptual common ground can grow, and let's say they get to a number that makes the union happy, whatever that number is, assume it's lower than 100, because, you know, it's what happens. And maybe the union gets some other things it wants. Well, then probably I would guess what happens is the union says, okay, we don't need to get guys to arbitration after 2 years, right? The standard right now is 3 years. That's how long it takes for most guys to get to arbitration. Mm-hmm. The union's proposed pushing it to two. The owners definitely don't want to do that.
Right.
So that's how these things move, right? It's a, okay, you give us in one area and you start to feel like you're making a gain, and then maybe you let another area go. But, you know, one thing that's important to understand, it's not just about horse trading. If it was only about horse trading where I give up something and you get something of equivalent value, nothing would ever change, right? Like the ledger would always be the same. And over time, these things do change. And the players are making clear, we got to come out with more than we had overall. So it's not about giving up in one area to get in another area. And naturally, the owners don't want to do that. So I don't know if I answered your question, but that's kind of... those are the moving pieces. They are all moving pieces, right?
Right.
Players haven't identified one thing that they say we have to have. But like, for example, the CBT, the luxury tax, they're not going to accept, I don't think, the current amount of raises, right? We know it needs to go up more than it is. Mm-hmm. And you can kind of make those judgments in different areas. Like, this is too little, this is too little, this is too little.
So you touched on a couple of them, but we're going to go rapid fire. Evan and Ken Rosenthal wrote a pretty in-depth thing on The Athletic a couple of days ago, outlining kind of all the issues, the big picture ones, where everything stands. So encourage anybody to read that, but we'll just kind of go through a few of the issues you just talked about, arb, pre-arb, that type of stuff. But tell me, you know, basically a couple sentences each on where these things stand and why they're so important to either side. Start with minimum salary.
The game has gotten younger, right? Teams have figured out that younger players are the cheapest players. So naturally they like them. And so the number of young players has grown, and the union and the players want to get these guys more money, right? You don't get to the market until you've been in the bigs for 6 years. You don't get to arbitration until 3 years. And so those first 3 years, you're making the minimum. And so the minimum is a very important amount of money, particularly as teams keep, you know, calling up Joe Schmo reliever who you never heard of, who happens to throw 100, and then the guy disappears after he blows out his arm, right? I'm exaggerating a little, but that's kind of what's going on. And so it's the more money you can get to guys younger, the players feel is important.
Right. So you look at a guy like, you know, Devers in 2019, not the absolute minimum, but, you know, 614,000, and, you know, guys making in that range, despite being MVP candidates or all-stars, those types of things, because they have.
Well, this is one kind of interesting point on this. Okay. So you just noted that the Red Sox were paying Devers more than the minimum, right?
Right.
Teams have that ability to do that. They can choose to pay a guy above the minimum, and many teams do, like, to some varying degree, like, even though they don't have to. Mm-hmm. What the league has proposed most recently is to limit that, is to say, no, this is the salary you get if you're 0 to 1 year of service time. It's whatever. It's 615,000, and the team doesn't have the ability to say, I'm going to give you more than that. So that's a divisive thing for right. The players. The players don't like that.
Next up, we've kind of covered our pre-arb, but the luxury tax and then the possibility for a salary floor, is that still in the mix at all?
Now, the players would welcome a salary floor. The problem for the players is salary floors always come with salary caps or something that right. functions like a salary cap. So
when MLB do that anyway?
Well, we can get into that. In August, MLB proposed, I think it was August. We'll put in a floor at 100 million, but basically with the other hand, they lowered the first luxury tax to 180 and basically said it made the penalty so bad that if you go over, nobody was going to go over it. So you're basically cutting off free agency. You're mm-hmm. really hampering free agency. So the players aren't going to do that. You know, the argument with CBT, the league says, look, it's gone up a certain amount over time. And, you know, there's a typical amount, it goes up. The player argument is really, look how much revenues have gone up. And the CBT hasn't, you know, kept pace. Teams can afford more. And the league will argue competitive balance, you know, that, well, you can't have this disparity between small market teams and large market teams. So right now the league has proposed 214 going up to 220. In 2020, the last one, the year we just finished, was 210, right? So that's, right. that's where we ended. 210, league's proposed 214 going up to 220. The players have proposed, I think it's 240. I want to say 240 something going up to 273. Sorry, I don't remember everything off the top of my head, but you know, so there's a big gap there, and it's important to understand that it's not, there's an argument made sometimes that, well, most teams don't go over it, so it doesn't affect many teams or players. The players would argue that's not true. So if there are fewer bidders on a player because teams don't want to go over it, that impacts the whole market. So that it is a very significant restraint on what teams do, even if the number of teams not going over it. Well, how many teams are stopping short of it? And the other question, is it a quasi cap? Look, there are definitely teams, the Red Sox included, who have treated that threshold, that first tier, as something like a cap. It's
in
not
years with certain superstars. Yeah.
Yeah. Total 100%. And teams have gotten more overt about it to the point that you see owners talk about, you know, we got to stand luxury tax. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, whether they whether that's rational, whether the amount of money you actually have to commit to go over the first tier, it's really should deter you. At the end, it doesn't really matter. If even some teams are treating it that way, then you do have to, if you're the players, you take that information and account for it. It just, the technicality is, like, baseball doesn't, if you start to look at the salary cap systems in the other sports, baseball does not have a salary cap, right? There are literal limits on the amount of money that can be dispersed to players in a given year. There's escrow. Yeah. You know, you don't get all your money. So it's, we like to be technical here sometimes, but yeah, teams do treat it as an upper limit. There's no question.
What about that theory that, you know, teams, the Red Sox, Yankees, Dodgers, some of those big market teams sat out free agency in that initial wave because they figured that, you know, the it would go up so substantially that they'd be able to have a much better understanding and a bigger budget once this was all resolved and they can, and the freeze is up.
It doesn't really add up to me because no. That would assume that the large market owners would. I mean, their proposal was, like we just talked about, the August proposal was to lower it to 180. Yeah. There might be some large market owners that would like to spend more, but you know, they're pretty wise and understand that the less spending there is, the more they're going to make over time, right? Mm-hmm. Like they're not dumb business people, not always anyway. And then the premise is that the Red Sox and the Yankees and the Dodgers would have known that, like, yeah, the small that we would have been able to agree to this, right? Like, but you're seeing those owners, you know, Hal Steinbrenner and John Henry are on the labor policy committee, the 7-owner labor policy committee. You would have seen those owners. They don't know that they can get that, right? And I don't think they want to get that, is what I'm trying to say.
So a convenient cop out is what you're saying.
I don't really remember hearing that, but maybe you did. Maybe it was a Boston thing that they're waiting because that's assuming that, like, A, the Red Sox and Yankees owners want it, and B, that the rest of the owners would agree to it. And I don't think either that's actually true. Like, right. Maybe the Yankees and Red Sox wouldn't mind being able to spend a little bit more, but, like, look at, I mean, they like making a lot of money, and the lower the CBT is, the more money they're going to make.
Next up, an interesting one that we've never seen before, but the draft lottery. Where do things stand with that?
Yeah, well, you know, it's about tanking, right? So you have this problem where teams...
Tanking's a very very popular issue today out there on the Twitter sphere.
Why? What happened?
I think Brian Flores made some accusations to the Dolphins and Hugh Jackson about the Browns and some tanking in the NFL.
Yeah, that'll be
interesting. I know you're so one-track mind on baseball, but...
I was baiting you.
I know.
You. Yeah, look, the players are, you know, as we said, young talent is cheap. How do you get young talent? Through the draft. You know, these players are cost controlled. And so teams like those players, and you had teams that are losing essentially intentionally to get those draft picks. And so the players want to take away the incentive to do that. And both sides have proposed variants of a lottery. The league's variant would have the top 3 picks decided by lottery. The player's variant would have the top 8 picks. There are other things with it that the players are also proposing some other restrictions and incentives because they basically, the player feeling is that the league's proposal to have it just be 3 picks isn't enough. So if you finish with the worst record in baseball under the league's proposal, the worst you could pick the next year is 4th. So if you missed, if you didn't get the one of the top 3 picks, after the top 3 picks, it just goes back to reverse order, right? Okay. So you're getting the 4th pick. And
you can sometimes be the best player in the draft.
Right. Like, baseball's draft is, it's just not as certain. So like, yeah, would you rather have the 4th pick or would you rather have the 15th pick? You're still probably going to fight for the 4th pick.
Yeah.
Is the working logic there. So the players just don't think the league proposal goes far enough. You know, the owners like the ability to not spend money. And I would make sure people understand one of the great values of tanking is you don't have to spend money in that time, right? Mm-hmm. You are incentivized to have a bad roster. What is a bad roster? Often it's a cheap roster,
right?
So you're basically saying you can take a few years off and then spend when you're ready.
Service time manipulation. This is obviously one that comes up every year, and that, it's just a pretty blatant thing that happens, and it seems like players trying to get that out of the game.
Yeah, and they don't feel like the league has tried to do enough on it. It's a hard look when service time is counted by days. When you have a counting of days system, what's been explained to me is that it is literally impossible to totally eliminate it.
Yeah.
You can always mess around with it because you're counting dates. Like, you'd have to go to an age-based system, which was talked about briefly and is not going to happen this go around. So it's a question of what can you do to actually give teams a reason to call a player up. There's both sides now have a conceptual interest in giving a draft pick to teams. If a guy performs well as you know, top prospect does perform well. It's basically around, okay, if a guy comes up and deserves a year of service, he wins rookie of the year. If he's top five in this voting, top X in wins above replacement at his position, be it top 20, top seven, depends on the position, then yeah, that guy deserves a year of service. That's the core of the union proposal is, doesn't matter if you call this guy up on April 1st or April 20th, if he performs well enough, you're giving him that year of service.
Mm-hmm. That'll be, when all that was figured out, that'll be fun to track in real time with certain players. So it won't be complicated at all.
Yeah, I'm sure you'll do that.
Yeah, and last two things, expanded playoffs and the universal DH. I think the universal DH is just going to happen. Right?
Both are going to happen because, you know, you talk, like I said earlier, it's not all about trading, right? But these are, both sides should have reasons to want the universal DH, including, you can argue health. It is a little bit of a give to the players money-wise because it's a position that teams will pay for. Not as much as they used to, right? There's not a bunch of David Ortiz types, right? Never mind. But the old school DH is not really around anymore. And look, the owners want to expand the playoffs because they get more TV money. It's significant money to them. So it's something the players have to give. So yeah, those two are going to happen. The question on expanded playoffs is how many teams are in. The players have proposed 12. The league has proposed 14. Players actually proposed realigning divisions to have it be two divisions instead of three. I think mostly for scheduling purposes is my understanding. So, I mean, I guess something could change, but like, yeah, I would predict that the universal DH and the expanded playoffs will be a part of this deal.
So that's two things that you can safely say around. That's about it at this point because there's
you can probably safely say you're going to see a pre-R bonus pool.
Yeah.
Right. Like if you're talking about changes in this deal, probably going to see that. You're probably going to see some. Both sides now like the idea of a draft pick with service time manipulation. Like maybe that's likely. You know, when you start to get to the conceptual thing, agreement. You know, then it's a matter of negotiating the numbers, and that's my understanding is that's usually easier to do.
And the last one, this is the one that affects me the most, is the Fenway Park media dining on the table as they sit down and discuss these issues.
You know, the lobster rolls they provide in the playoffs are very
allergy.
Nice.
Shellfish allergy. Yeah.
Well, that's not going to do well for you. I haven't had Red Sox media dining in a few years, so I don't want to put anyone down. I do, you know, but I was there for a period of time, and I would say it. It's probably a little better in the earlier years, but you know, there's some people working hard there. I don't want to trash it. You know, not everybody has a cafeteria in their place of work. So we're very fortunate. Yada, yada. Get me in trouble.
Positive spin from Evan Drellick as we close things out. So that's basically everything you need to know about the lockout in less than 30 minutes. That was surprisingly good. Thank you.
Yeah, it was great, Chris. Let's do it again soon or something.